Dialogue Conspiracy. Political research specialist Mae Brussel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for over 2.5 years shared with KLRB listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and other abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary on KLRB-FM is the most hard-hitting and comprehensive report of its kind in the country, relating as it does the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. Dialogue Conspiracy, a unique talk show. It's the most up-to-date, well-documented, no-nonsense political analysis going. And it goes over KLRB FM 102 on Monday afternoons at 5:15.
Good afternoon. This is Dialogue Conspiracy, November the 5th, 1973. This is 125 in the series, going 2.5 years. We're adding new stations every week and picking up new stations, and I hope my listeners will get used to a certain time in the cities from New York to California. Whoever is playing the show will get used to the format of the show. Get your tape cassettes out before the show goes on. Get used to a certain time that it's on. Call your friends. Call your neighbors. Get a pencil. I'm going to give you addresses to write, recommendations of books to read. This isn't like the usual news format that you hear on the radio. This is a course. I like to think of it as a course where we're all learning together. And I read a lot of books and documents, share that with you, and you're expected to pass it on and to follow through on your own and do your homework until the next week, until we meet again. We talk about conspiracies, the conspiracies that originate from the National Security Council, the Domestic Security Council, the Office of Management Budget, implemented by the armed forces, the intelligence agencies, ordered by the President of the United States, fully mobilized to serve the corporates, whoever they are, who've put the President into power, or certain members of Congress that represent those vested interests. We're talking about the conspiracies that create dictatorships, that implement coups all over the world, that put in fascism in many countries continuously, that assassinate leaders, public officials, set the emotional climate of specific nations, and particularly our own. Most of the work I go into, I'll make references to Chile or Brazil or Greece, but I'm talking about the United States of America, where this is happening. So Dialogue Conspiracy covers those conspiracies that are planned against people inside the United States. For the people on the East Coast who get this show, next week, on the 23rd, it'll be the 23rd by the time they'll be playing this, 23rd of November, and the 24th, there's going to be a conference in Washington, D.C., on the anniversary, 10th anniversary of the assassination of President John Kennedy. Various researchers are getting together in Washington, D.C. and having a conference. They'll discuss the evidence of the John Kennedy assassination with various movies and documentaries that will be shown, indicating the fact that Oswald did not fire a weapon. As a matter of fact, he'd never owned a weapon in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, maybe when he was a young boy, but not as an adult in America. Not in the book depository. He didn't shoot that rifle, and he didn't own that rifle. They're going to cover at the conference the assassination of Robert Kennedy and the evidence that Sirhan Sirhan did not kill Robert Kennedy, and the discussion will be about James Ray and the fact that he did not kill Martin Luther King, and evidence of the Wallace shooting they'll be going into back there. I say they. I may be there. I may not be there. I'm down on the program as being there. November the 23rd, I may be there for 2 days. I haven't decided yet. It's at Georgetown University. For those of you that are able to attend over Thanksgiving vacation, there'll be a large auditorium. It'll hold 800 people, and if there's more than that, they'll have double sessions. There'll be the program for 2 days from 10 in the morning until 5 o'clock. There'll be demonstrations of the National Archive, and on the building, on the side of the building, they're going to project the Zapruder film showing the killing of President John Kennedy and his head going backwards, and the famous Zapruder film will be shown at the National Archives, and there will be the showings of the movie The Second Gun and also the executive action, one on the Robert Kennedy assassination, the other on the John Kennedy assassination. That will be part of the two-day program. So all of you who are interested in going, This will take place at Georgetown University in the main auditorium there Friday and Saturday, November 23rd and 24th, and then Friday night there'll be a dinner and get-together of all the various researchers. I'm going to talk today, as much as time allows, I could do an hour on each of these subjects, on the recommended Attorney General Saxby, on the probably the new President of the United States will be Gerald Ford, if Nixon sticks it out, but otherwise he would be Vice President. There's every reason to believe that he'll be rushed through and then become President. And on Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski. We're going to talk about those three men because of their relationships to the Warren Commission, the espionage establishment, and the difficulty of ever getting conspiracies opened up if this team gets into power. It doesn't give the researchers very much time. We've been working hard for 10 years, and some work a little less than 2 years, but it doesn't give us much time to get the facts to the people if this team does, in fact, get into placement. This is the second team, the backup team, and if they get into placement, the investigations will be stopped. As you heard on the news tonight, the new Attorney General Saxby wouldn't open the Kent State. The evidence is overwhelming, just like in the Martin Luther King case or the Robert Kennedy or John Kennedy, of a conspiracy, a plan to shoot the students, the follow-up of the planning, the reward or the promotion of one of the men, Terrence Norman, who shot one of the students. He's with the Washington Police Department riot squad now. If the Justice Department continues like they did with John Mitchell and Patrick Gray to cover their conspiracies continuously in the Johnson administration, these truths will never be told except by word of mouth to the citizens until they get to a position where they still can't rise up. You can't move these people out of office with facts. Every fact to prove a conspiracy, they can destroy, lock up, alter, because it's in their custody, and they have no intention of telling the people in this nation how these various conspiracies are coming down that I talk about. But on this radio program, I've talked for the last few weeks and through many, many shows about one of the big dangers in our country that is a very serious problem, and that is the information that I have connected to the Office of Emergency Service, that two-way radio into our homes, the program to eliminate 63 million minority, and I'm getting a lot of information in addition to the original research I had from a particular gentleman in San Francisco who is making a movie at the present time on dune buggies because he has four reasons. He says the American government is making these things, and he used to work for that team. One is to plow into the hippie communes, and the other is to use in Africa and the Middle East. They're made by the military, and he gave a lot of warning about the dune buggy scene in the last few months in tapes he had sent to me. And with that in mind, and with plans in mind that I see happening in the administration, as we're being very carefully directed to all attention to the tapes, a very important thing happened in California this week, and it's important for all of the nation. It's a California problem, but it's New York, too, and every state in between. There was a small article in the newspaper, a very tiny article. I take 8 papers a day, and this was only in one, and it was just at the bottom of a column, Lieutenant Governor Ed Reinecke mentioned different problems in the state, and one of them was that the Bureau of Land Management had acted in what he said was arbitrarily when they decided to close 12.5 million acres of California desert to off-road vehicles. And he blamed it on the cold, harsh hand of federal bureaucracy. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, that 12 million acres were being cut off to all off-road vehicles, because I remembered the Charlie Manson case and the use of dune buggies and what this other gentleman was telling me about dune buggies. And I know Manson was at the Barker Ranch, which was a safe house, the Sharon Tate massacre, the LaBianca, I've said for several years, was an Army intelligence operation, but Manson was violently anti-black, and he was waiting for this great race war, and they were accumulating and working on dune buggies out at this particular ranch. And then after I read this tiny article in the San Jose Mercury about 12 million acres being closed off, I saw one more article in the New York Times, a California Association of Four-Wheel Drive Club, asked in San Diego to end the blocking off of this land. 94% of this vast territory will not be used open roads for people to examine and see what's going on. And I consider this a dire state of emergency in the United States. I know this particular gentleman in San Francisco told about the plans to kill 63 million minority people, one-third of the population. Now, the game plan, I was going to continue on the program this week from last week, the game plans that are planned in Cambridge, Massachusetts for the third world apply to America, and one of them is called Camelot. The third world countries are no more a danger than the third world in the United States, where you have 20 million blacks, Chicanos, Indians, hippies, counterculture. And this figure that I got from this particular gentleman was approximately 63 million people intent were planning to be killed in the United States. And he had linked it to two airports that would be used for transporting. One was in Texas and one in Prunedale. And I remembered the book Reinhard Gehlen's Spy of the Century. It's written by Cookridge. It was a book describing Reinhard Gehlen. I've used it on other programs, and I use it in reference to these 12 million acres, that the plans for Nazi Germany when they took over Russia were to colonize the eastern part of Moscow and the Ukraine and make 40 million people subhuman, in that they would get basic education and agricultural training. And the remaining 50 million would be killed by a natural means, namely famine. And when you think that Mr. Reinhard Gehlen was given 200 million by our CIA and Alan Dulles, and his ingenious ideas were incorporated to make our OSS the CIA, it isn't beyond the realm of possibility that this land is going to be earmarked in case there are uprisings in this country, which have to come about because of what's happening to our domestic programs. Eventually, the people are going to have to rise up. So before anything is built on this land, fences or marked off areas, I think it's important to write to Sacramento, people that are listening to this show, and write to Washington, D.C., to various congressmen. The theory behind the Bureau of Land Management in arbitrarily closing 12 million acres of desert land was that they had some dune buggy accidents, that 140 persons were killed in dune buggies, and that 2,000 were injured in recreational desert accidents. Well, if that were true, they'd close every highway or freeway. 140 persons were killed, they claim, by dune buggies this year. I don't believe that, because I take the Los Angeles Times, I take, as I say, 8 papers a day, I read the obituaries, I don't see these continuous dune buggy accidents or deaths by dune buggies at all. I haven't read any of that at all. And the excuse, always the fascism comes in, an excuse to protect us from ourselves. So these many acres, 12 million acres in California, are being closed off because they said 140 people died in dune buggies. I don't believe the figures. I don't believe this area should be closed off. I think the area should be open, and I think it's an important thing to not have this happen. In California, we did have the Japanese internment camps where they were all picked up. The Pearl Harbor took place, respectable members of the community, their families, their homes emptied out, and I think it's very important to act swiftly and continuously. Don't let the thing die. I think you should be asking. What the Bureau of Land Management has closed off 12 million acres, and I think the excuse in Nazi Germany is we didn't know where Buchenwald was, we didn't know what Auschwitz was for, we didn't know where Dachau was. Well, here is this land at a time where we're talking about military coup or martial law or plans for extermination. Some people inside the agency are revealing this, and it's a factor which disturbs them enough to give out information about the military-built dune buggies and what they intend to do with them. And there's a large airport planned out near Prunedale. Howard Hughes and the large aircraft manufacturers are arranging just at the edge of this desert for supersonic and large airport that wouldn't possibly be used for anything except transplanting large masses of people. The new Texas airport has to be linked with this, too, with its 66 gates, and it's the size of Manhattan Island almost. It can't service the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and it's way out of town. So the two airports that this particular gentleman had told me about, and he was making a movie concerned about dune buggies and the military use of dune buggies and the plans to exterminate, and then this land was closed off this week. So I think that wherever this program is, you should barrage, if you can, congressmen and in the east and out in the west, and find out what this is about and get those roads open. I don't believe they have to be closed. I'm dwelling it at length because it's terribly important. It's important because as I see Mr. Saxby and Jaworski and Gerald Ford get right into prime position, as part of the espionage establishment, then I know that they're capable, these men are capable of allowing these things to happen, because Gerald Ford, will go into it, was capable of being part of the cover-up of the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, California is having an election. It'll be tomorrow here. It will be over by the time these tapes get around to the other stations. But it's worth talking about whether the Proposition 1 wins or loses. I have to spend a few minutes on it for the simple reason that Ronald Reagan wants to be president of the United States. So it's California's problem now. It's yours tomorrow. If Proposition's defeated, a little air will be out of his balloons. But I don't believe that a man gives up that easily, and the people behind him don't give up that easily either. This election out here is being forced on the citizens. It's going to cost between $6.7 million and $34 million to have an election on November the 6th for this Proposition 1 that could have waited until June. Kenneth Hahn, the L.A. supervisor, said it's costing California taxpayers $34 million approximately to push the election on orders of Ronald Reagan now instead of 5-6 months later. This is Reagan's baby. It's his brainchild. He's testing his oats for presidential timber and he's throwing out something that is obnoxious to many, many branches of this state or the people of the United States. But I think it's a good test on how far he can get away with things. California is often described as the first para-fascist state, but there's 49 more, and the way California goes, you can go too. It's been said that by the time this gets in, if it is successful, Ronald Reagan will be off dancing in Mississippi, winning the Southern majority, and he's on his way down there to visit in the next week. If Proposition wins, he won't be around to hear the screaming and yelling. Proposition 1 is a constitutional amendment to limit state expenditures and taxes. George Reading, a newspaper man in California, asked Ronald Reagan, "Do you think the average voter really understands the language of the proposition?" And Reagan said, "No, he couldn't. I don't either." There was a $2 million fund, a ratio of 5-1, to get this through. We're talking about time of limiting the election expenses. You see, this doesn't go into all the new bills that Washington is doing. $2 million is spent for propaganda to get this in, and if this gets in, then Reagan has more clout. So how do you put in dollars and cents how much it would cost to make Ronald Reagan president of the United States? As much as Richard Nixon by the time he's through. The people against Proposition 1, Assembly Speaker Bob Moretti said 14 conservatives would own the state of California. They just about do now. And Charles Hitch, president of the University of California, said the passage would cut the campuses. The reason I talk about Proposition 1, even though we vote out here tomorrow and it will be over when you get there, is to show you the kind of people that are for Ronald Reagan out in this state and who are against him. And then you can figure out when the elections come around if he's the kind of man that we want for presidential timber at any time. Of course, the cattle ranchers are for Ronald Reagan. The farmers are for him. The Real Estate Association. I have a list of people that are supporting this particular bill. They're all brokers, the farmers, and real estate people. And who's against it? The Chamber of Commerce, the California Real Estate Association, the California Mortgage Bankers, a long list of bankers are for this particular reducing the taxes and having a maximum of tax that people can pay. The apartment house owners, the motel owners, and property owners associations up and down the state. They don't want to pay any more taxes. They've had enough taxes. They want to put a limit. And that makes sense from their standpoint. But who loses if there's taxes in the states? Who benefits when they have taxes? The University of California is going to lose, or the educational system will lose $304 million. The minority scholarships for the poor, $121 million would be cut off. They want to cut off the money to the prisons. It would cut up to $4 million. When a man leaves San Quentin or a California prison, he walks out with $68. He was to get $200. It'd reduce it again. If he's in there 5, 6, 10 years, he gets $68 and out with an old suit, and he's supposed to be on his way instead of $200 to hold him over till he can find some kind of employment. The list of people that are against Proposition 1 are the League of Women Voters, who covered it carefully, the parents and teachers organizations, education organizations, advancement of colored people, the Chicano groups, the Library Association, the parks, the ecology organizations, the retarded, the Sierra Club, labor groups from all over, the United Steelworkers, the American Association of Retired People, Americans for Democratic Action, women's students, Indian educators, the departments, the local mental health departments, young Democrats, research groups, tax reform groups, United Latin American Citizens, Public Employees Associations, United Steelworkers, Housing Coalitions, California School Employees, Student Presidents, I don't have to go further, Association of Recreation and Parks, anything that represents the welfare of the people. There was a question asked Gerald Ford at the congressional hearings, how come he's so interested in what happens in foreign countries and not in domestic programs. Everything is more weapons and more money for weapons and weapon systems till we have total insanity up and down this state and across the country, and nothing for the people. So you limit the taxes, and then the money doesn't go to school scholarships, libraries, parks, ecological improvements, the old, the blind, the crippled, the mentally sick, retarded. They're supposed to be ignored, millions off the university, teachers' salaries, anything that makes life better, sweeter, more intelligent, more refined. That cut that all out. Give the people who have investment in land and investment in property and large ranches and big buildings and condominiums, they're paying too much. They're all well off and they're living off the fat of the land, but they shouldn't have to pay more. And that's the way it's going in California, if that's what you want. Now we'll go on to Mr. Saxby. Senator William Saxby of Ohio has been nominated to be the next Attorney General. I just have a list of six qualifications that fit his profile. You know, as it turned out, that Howard Hunt and Mr. Malloy of the CIA have psychological profiles on alleged assassins. Well, I have a psychological profile on who would be a good member of the Nixon administration teamwork, or the representative of ITT and Howard Hughes and the people that give their orders to Richard Nixon. In the first place, Senator Saxby, listing his homes in Ohio and his ski resort, he also has one in Costa Rica, which he was very careful to say is for recreation. Well, what else do you do in Costa Rica besides espionage work? We know that Howard Hughes owns Costa Rica, just like his investment in the Bahamas and Nicaragua. Robert Vesco is hiding down there from three indictments with the federal government. We know that the recreation down in Costa Rica, we know there's a lot more going on, too, and he goes down there for his recreation, just like Nixon goes down to the Bahamas. He doesn't go for sunshine. He can get that in Florida. He goes down there for his briefings and his orders, and that's what's going down in Costa Rica with Mr. Saxby. The second thing was his investment in the pinball machines. That makes him eligible for the Rebozo Howard Hughes Nixon Underworld Syndicate, because his company, he had investments in the Bally Manufacturing Company of Chicago, a major slot machine and pinball company. Now, that's one of his investments, the pinball machine. So that's the second thing that makes him eligible to be the Attorney General. The third thing is that he wants to close the investigation of the Kent State, and he's surprised that Mr. Richardson would think to open it, because in the ilk of the other Justice Departments, their job is to close every conspiracy and not let you know how the gunman actually had the orders to kill and why the killing was necessary to perpetuate the power system. The fourth thing is he was a retired member of the National Guard and was four National Guards who, upon a signal from a gun, shot 13 students and killed four at Kent State, who are all unarmed and going in the other direction down the hill. The fifth thing is that he's a qualified to be a member of the Justice Department as the Attorney General, because one of the firms that he worked for, that he had investment in, the Bally Manufacturing, is now under investigation by the federal department. It seems that all of these men who are appointed have in some way with their clients or otherwise been or are investigated by the Justice Department, so he qualifies with that. He owns 600 shares in a company that's being investigated by the Justice Department. And then allegedly in the news today, he gave a speech at Hong Kong where he made the statement in August 73, if Richard Nixon had the tapes, he should destroy them and then deny what was on them. Well, that's in the ilk of Dean and Haldeman or Ehrlichman or Nixon or Patrick Gray or John Mitchell. Destroy the evidence and then deny. That's a typical espionage operation. I could list all the pieces of evidence that were destroyed in the past, criminal conspiracies. Why not destroy it and then deny it? You know how the denials of Spiro Agnew went on and on. I won't retire. I'm being smeared. And then it turned out there were 40 counts against him he could have been indicted for. The denial of Mr. Saxby doesn't mean a thing. His profile is just beautiful for the new Attorney General. Then we get on to Mr. Ford, the new President of the United States, maybe. I don't understand Edward Kennedy came out this week and urged prompt Senate action on the Vice President nomination of Gerald Ford. He said to avoid the appearance of partisan political consideration. Why he's bending over backwards, I really don't know, but I can't believe that Ted Kennedy wants a hurry-up job on a man who was a member of the Warren Commission and did the kind of work that he did investigating his own brother's murder. That doesn't mean he has to come out and attack Gerald Ford, but he doesn't have to support the nomination. And I should think, with all the serious research that's been done and all the evidence that Ford was part of the cover-up, that he'd just keep his mouth shut. And I can't imagine what kind of prodding they have to do this man that he comes out and volunteers that Ford should be vice president or president. Gerald Ford was before the Senate hearings this week. They asked him his opinion of the Watergate, and what he said, a handful of people in high places did stupid things, and he can't believe, he said, it's unbelievable, the impact that a few stupid people in high places do. Well, people in high places who get caught are stupid. If they don't get caught, they're praised to high heaven, and they get wonderful accolades at dinner parties and banquets. But if they get caught, it's just stupid. He can't believe how unbelievable it is that people are making such a fuss. He doesn't talk about the way Senator Muskie was knocked out of the nomination, or the bugging of homes and offices and forging documents and stealing doctors' records and State Department papers and burning papers and shredding and dumping evidence into the river, covering up investigations, refusal to obey court orders, or the secret army inside the White House built up by the intelligence agencies. He can't recognize this because he's a part of it. And don't think he's not a part of it. They asked him about $5,000 that he was paid for a Life magazine article. At the time, he was a member of the Warren Commission. And he gave out a revealing statement that a Mr. John Ray, retired from AT&T, helped put it together. I don't know if he meant to say IT&T or AT&T, or how much the communications of AT&T is tied to ITT, but I think it's interesting that Life magazine, and I was aware of this all along, carried the perpetuation of the lie that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin, and it's Charles Colson who would call Life magazine and show him a peek at a forged document of John Kennedy ordering the death of DM. I have about 54 instances of where Life magazine was used in collusion with the espionage branch of the United States government to perpetuate their cover stories and lies. We could do a whole show on that. He also talked about his book. He wasn't supposed to receive money as a member of Warren Commission writing a book, and he thought, he said before the Senate committee, he says the book he wrote was based on witness testimony, which is public to everybody, so he just put it in its historical context, and he said it was available for everybody to see. And the dumb senator sat there with their mouth open and went on to the next question. He didn't tell you the volumes cost $86, that they're out of print, that only 1,000 copies were sold, or 1,500 in the entire United States, that when you go to a library to take out these 26 volumes, one of them, you can't take them home, you have to sit there and read it. He didn't tell you that the testimony that he used for his book was highly prejudiced, based on CIA profile of a 23-year-old white male that had nothing to do with the assassination of President Kennedy and had everything to do with the cover story. He didn't tell you about the Warren Commission hearings of Oswald's high IQ, his admission to two colleges, his language skills, his training in electronics, his radio work, his top secret security clearances. Gerald Ford didn't write in his book about Oswald meeting at Santa Ana at a military base where a man relieved him while he met at night with plainclothes men. They handed him documents with a blue seal and gave him money. In his book, he doesn't tell you how Oswald got a passport to Europe while he was still in the Marines and went from Santa Ana to Finland and then over to the Soviet Union with $2,300 it cost him when he had $230 in the bank. He didn't tell you about, in the 26 volumes, about the passport, State Department papers, Navy documents, CIA documents, that Oswald was in the Marines in intelligence with the ability equivalent of an officer, or his arrival in New York City by spouse Reagan when he came home, who's head of the American Friends of Anti-Bolshevik Committee, the bloc of it's a group that meets new immigrants when they come. And Marina Oswald's family was known by the intelligence agencies at this side. He doesn't tell you about Oswald being met in New York by a man associated with the Galen operation, the same Nazi espionage team that was behind the entire Cold War. He doesn't tell you about Oswald's relationship to the U-2 flights or Gary Powers or James McCord, E. Howard Hunt, or Alan Dulles. Mr. Ford writes a book on Oswald. It's a complete piece of fiction. I wish, in addition to writing letters about these 12 million acres being closed off, that you write to the Senate Judiciary. Here are some names you can write to. You can write to Mr. Hart, Philip Hart, Sam Irvin, Birch Bayh, B-A-Y-H, Quentin Burdick, Robert Byrd, or John Tunney, those five. Go to your library and get a list of members of the Senate Judiciary and ask them to ask this question at these hearings, because they said they'd call Gerald Ford back. The Rules Committee would. The Judiciary is going to hear this. In 1968, Gerald Ford made the statement on November 23, 1968. He says, "At such time as I see any new evidence, I would be glad to examine it or have responsible authority or groups other than the Warren Commission consider that." Now, he knows the commission was disbanded. So write a letter to the Judiciary. And let's ask them to have Mae Brussel there to speak before them and refute everything in Gerald Ford's book and find out if this wasn't a piece of propaganda for the espionage establishment. And then I got a letter in the mail this week from American Conservative Society and Human Events, and they listed their favorite who's who of American conservatives. There's Representative John Ashbrook, Patrick Buchanan, Alan Drury, and then has Gerald Ford, Clarence Mannion, and Otto Tepka, Strom Thurmond, and John Tower, John Wayne, and Charles Whitaker, Honorable Charles Whitaker. So these are the great, proud conservatives in this country, and Gerald Ford sits among them. Well, last but not least, the next 10 minutes we're going to talk about Leon Jaworski. He has been named the new prosecutor of the after Archibald Cox was removed from office. And we have the assurance of Mr. Dvorak that the man will, Robert Bork, rather, the acting attorney general, that he is free to act and that he will, nobody will hamper his investigation. I have news for you. If Leon Jaworski does the investigation, you won't have to tell him where to stop because he'll stop before he starts. Leon Jaworski was appointed by Robert Bork and he had free clearance. They knew his background. And if he's a special prosecutor, he requires no Senate confirmation, and this is horrendous. He was the prosecutor, one of them, of Nazi war criminals. At the time when the two biggest criminals of the rocket factories, Mr. von Braun, Werner von Braun, and Mr. Dornberger, were being brought into the Southwest, right into the Texas area, and the CIA entourage at Bell Aerospace, Mr. Dornberger went, and instead of being prosecuted as a war criminal, like the British said at Nuremberg, he was shipped out to Fort Worth, Texas, and Mr. Jaworski investigated those war crimes. He was on the advisory commission following the death of Robert Kennedy. That's when the LEAA was founded, which put into existence the American Nazi kind of plans, the laws that provide for all the electronic police we have now, the data banks, brain experimentation, use of military hardware, and surveillance inside the United States. He's described as a man behind the scenes, and I want to refer you to some articles. In Newsweek, in March the 6th, 1967, New York Times, February the 14th, 1969, the San Francisco Chronicle, February the 18th, in 1967. Oh, the New York Times is a 67 article, too. Leon Jaworski was the head of the Anderson Foundation, the CIA Foundation in Houston, Texas, and still is part of the CIA. Richard Hardwood did a series in the Times Post Service when the exposure of the CIA in America and the domestic foundations came out. I'm reading from the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle. It said there was mounting evidence yesterday that leaders of the American business establishment have been deeply involved in covert operations of the CIA inside the United States. In Dallas, Texas, there's a charitable foundation intimately associated with the Republican National Bank that's been receiving CIA funds since 58. Now, this was written just shortly after the Kennedy assassination. One of the foundation trustees is federal judge Sarah T. Hughes, who administered the oath of office to President Johnson following the assassination of President Kennedy. In Houston, another foundation closely associated with the Texas business community apparently passed $655,000 in CIA funds since 58. The foundation's attorney and one of its trustees is Leon Jaworski, a friend of President Johnson, who's been rumored from time to time to be up for appointment of Attorney General of the United States. In Houston yesterday, Jaworski refused to discuss the financial affairs of the Anderson Foundation, nor would he discuss the possibility of links between the foundation and the CIA, but his silence was not to be interpreted as a confirmation or denial that the link exists. The beneficiary of his CIA foundations that he was a lawyer for and a trustee went to the American Fund of the Free Jurists in New York City. Now, these articles that came out in 67, and I have a whole series of them, and in 69, had a list of the way these foundations operate, and they go this way. You have a front organization. There's a diagram called the Gotham Foundation, the Borden Trust Foundation, the Beacon Trust, the Michigan Fund. Michigan reminds me of Gerald Ford. Then they go into conduits, such as the Anderson Foundation in Houston. That's the one Jaworski was on the board of directors and lawyer for. The Frederick Brown Foundation in Boston. There's 31 listed. I have a list of 31 trust fronts that are trust. Then there's 31 conduits they go to. Then that money goes to groups like the Friends of the Middle East, and that is the group that pays for the Arab guerrilla movement in order to guarantee that they will stir up the trouble against Israel. I've watched this for a long time. Sirhan Sirhan was back with that Middle East group shortly before he was involved with the Robert Kennedy assassination. The Friends of the... You see, we don't send American money and dollars to the Arab guerrillas to blow up a kibbutz or make war with Israel. That would look like America was paying to instigate a little war. We give it, the CIA, your tax dollar, goes to the Beacon Trust Fund or the San Miguel Fund. Then it goes to the Anderson Foundation in Houston. Then the Anderson Foundation sends it to the Friends of the Middle East, and then it goes into the pocket of the guerrilla movement. Another group that they fund is the Greek Orthodox Church. Now, that's the group that brought Marina Oswald to this country, that brought the Sirhan family over here in 1948. The Greek Orthodox Church is in Houston, Texas. It's all over the United States, but that is one of the recipients of this group. And then the National Student Associations and the Peace Corps was infiltrated with spies until finally the various countries suspected us because of good intentions were ruined and messed up with CIA spies sent along with the good kids that wanted to help. Leon Jaworski represents one of the largest law firms in the United States, a huge financial firm in Houston. It's called the Fulbright Crooker Jaworski Law Firm. He's promised a full cooperation of the executive branch in the pursuit of the investigation, but Jaworski has not been mentioned in terms of the role that the Houston money played at the Watergate. Remember how important it was that the President of the United States ordered the CIA and the FBI to stop looking for the money that was in Bernard Barker's bank because it came from Houston. It came from those CIA foundations. Houston's involved in the wheat deal, the El Paso gas deal that should be investigated, the Houston money and the money washing that ended up in Barker's bank that went down to the Mexican bank accounts. It's involved with CIA contacts in Mexico. And Howard Hughes' name came up at the time that Cox was fired because of his funding of cash to Richard Nixon and through Houston, Texas. Howard Hughes gave $150,000 that he's admitting. But that's the home base, Hughes Tool Company. The home base is Houston, Texas. And John Conley's name has been linked from Houston, Texas with the ITT and the Melk Funds and the Justice Department. And John Mitchell's name has been linked with the plane crash that went over Chicago and Houston, CIA funds, the El Paso gas deal. Those are all mixed up with Houston, and the President of the United States has the nerve to suggest as a prosecutor, a man from Houston, Texas, that's up to his neck with CIA foundations. And there's worse yet than on Leon Jaworski, but it's just a terrible nerve to bring a man in like that. In addition to that, he has companies that he is on the board of directors of. These are the companies, the Coastal States Gas Corporation, the Bank of the Southwest, Anderson Clayton Company, that's the CIA Foundation, the Houston Intercontinental National Bank, and the Village National Bank. And three of the companies that he's on board of directors for are investigation in the Justice Department. One by the Security Exchange Commission has a suit against one of Leon Jaworski's corporations, the Coastal States, because they failed to disclose data of the natural gas reserves and the ability to deliver. And that links in what I think are the contrived fuel shortages to take our mind off the Watergate. The Security and Exchange Commission has a suit against one of its five corporations. Now, there's antitrust suits against Texaco and subsidiary Coastal States of two other groups that he is on the board of directors of before the Justice Department at this time. To me, it is outrageous that a man like this, who's on the board of directors of three companies that are being investigated, one by the Security Exchange Commission and two by the United States District Court, one in Wilmington, Delaware, another one in New York City, against his corporations, and he is going to be the prosecutor of this sensitive area. You see, if the Watergate is investigated properly, it'll go all the way from the Watergate Hotel to Dallas, Texas, and the assassination of John Kennedy. But when you have a man as a prosecutor who was part of the cover-up of the assassination of John Kennedy, who worked for the Texas and the Warren Commission, like Leon Jaworski, and you have Mr. Ford, who was on the Warren Commission, there is no way to uncover the truth. A lot of us have worked for 10 years trying to uncover the truth of what happened. There's no way with these men in power. When the Warren Commission was formed, there was supposed to be earlier a Texas Board of Inquiry, which was a monkey trial to cover the whole thing. And Leon Jaworski was appointed to serve on that. But then Earl Warren located him as a contingent of the Warren Commission, and he sat in to see that the state of Texas did right by the Warren Commission. When Jack Ruby was in the cell with Earl Warren, and he wanted to tell what happened, but he thought he'd be killed in the cell, and he was very nervous. And he looked up, and he saw that two men came in, and he said, "I can't tell you." This is Jack Ruby, Volume 5 of the commission hearings. "I want to tell the truth, and I can't tell it here." And incidentally, Gerald Ford sat in that room with Earl Warren. He said, "I can't tell it here. Does that make sense to you?" And Chief Justice Warren said, "Well, let's not talk about sense. I can't see why you can't tell the commission." Then Ruby looked up, and there were two lawyers there, and he said to one of them, "What's your name?" And the one man said, "I'm Joe Ball." And Joe Ball, incidentally, is the lawyer for Mr. Ehrlichman right now, if you don't think that's tight case. So Joe Ball was one of the men in the room. Then there was another man in the room, and he didn't want to talk up. He says, "Who can I talk up? Is it safe?" And he says, "Who is this other man?" And Mr. Rankin, the chief counsel for the commission, said, "This is Mr. Story from your community, a lawyer working with the attorney general. And that's Mr. Jaworski, in connection with watching the work of the Warren Commission, so that they will be satisfied as to the quality of the work done insofar as the state of Texas is concerned." That's Volume 5 of the commission hearings. Mr. Jaworski was protecting the interests of the state of Texas because the man who was governor of that state, John Conley, would want to be president of the United States someday. The man who was on the Warren Commission that sat in that room that day, Gerald Ford, will be president of the United States till John Conley takes over. He has his way. And Mr. Jaworski, if it's credible, is supposed to investigate that can of worms. I could do an hour show on Mr. Jaworski, Gerald Ford, and the entire team in Washington. It's a disgrace, and it's almost an unbelievable epitaph or a thing at the end of 10 years to see these men in the position of power they're in today, Mr. Saxby, Gerald Ford, and Leon Jaworski. But that's it. Our time is up, and we have to live with the bad news as it falls and hope that as things come down and they seem to be getting worse, that you're listening and taking tapes and talking about these things and getting educated, so in the event they want this discussion to stop, you will have had some inkling at least of what's been taking place the past 10 years. Thank you very much, and I'll be with you next week.